Welcome, and thanks for listening to Intrinsic Investigations. My name is Mr. Olivo, and I created this podcast because I've been fortunate enough over the last decade to see unique and thought-provoking projects happen in my classroom, and we wanted a place to showcase them. The true heart of this podcast lies not in the content discovered, but in exploring the personal stories of these young researchers as they journey through uncharted and unfamiliar intellectual terrain. By sharing their stories, we hope to normalize the challenges and frustrations that come with independent research, and also share those moments where students transcend the normal grind of the school day to discover concepts that range from the global to deeply personal. We will begin with a brief introduction to the student of focus, why they pick their topic, and discuss their growth over the course of the last year. It should be mentioned that the opinions expressed in this podcast in no way reflect the opinions of our school district, Bergen County Technical Schools and Special Services, or our school itself, Bergen County Technical High School Teterboro, or the College Board. The work detailed in this podcast was most likely completed in AP Capstone, but this podcast is in no way affiliated with the College Board. It is May. The pollen count is high. So you're just going to have to forgive the coughing or general sniffling that may occur during the podcast. But for those of you with seasonal allergies, you understand. I have Wesley here. Wesley, tell the audience a little bit about yourself.
My name is Wesley, and I read the news every single day.
Every day.
Yeah, it's very consistent. I love learning about the world. I love learning about politics, geopolitics. That's something I'm very interested in. And, you know, around 2023, I started reading lots and lots of news surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. You're familiar with it, right? Of course.
I think everyone is familiar with it at this point, yeah.
But, you know, especially during 2023, people were inundated with headlines, news articles, clips, people talking about it. You know, I was a part of that. But what's really interesting to me is, depending on which news organizations I was reading from, their headlines gave a different reality of what was happening, which was really interesting. So that led me to explore like how news organizations will frame conflicts, most specifically the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to shape the reality of it.
Yeah, you just jumped right in. So let's get into this. Your work, while it's centered around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the problem that it seems like you're trying to explore is the use of language and headline framing. So like you said, this could apply to any conflict, whether it be in Yemen, the Ukraine, wherever. This is kind of the heart of what you were looking at. Before we get into how you approach this, why do you read the news every day? Like what for you is the motivation of being informed on conflicts that are global in nature, so they're not really impacting you in New Jersey directly. I'm not going to say or they may be. I don't want to make any assumptions here. Mm-hmm. So why consume as much news as you do? What do you see as the point of that?
Well, I think that especially living in the United States, even though we may not be directly like in conflicts or directly in some of the things that the United States does, we do contribute to it indirectly. And I think that literacy, like news literacy, global literacy, knowing about the world really influences our actions. For instance, when we take the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we as Americans, right, we vote, we advocate, we talk, you know, we lobby, and these lead to real changes, right? Political pressure can lead politicians to take actions that, you know, have ripple effects throughout the world.
Sure.
And our understanding is shaped by the news. And especially news headlines, which I wanted to explore throughout my research.
Right. Unless we have some kind of direct link to these events, whether it's through family or friends who are directly experiencing them, you're right. Probably the news, that is the testimony of others that is feeding our like logical, like I don't want to say logical framework, but our knowledge framework, whether or not we use that for logical reasons is debatable. About these things. So I think you're right. I think the way that we consume media impacts our perception, which can impact our behaviors, and on a larger scale, that could impact policy. How did you go about investigating this issue of headline framing. Where did you start? What news outlets did you try to compare? And what methods did you use? And if I know that there's a lot of questions, so let's just start with who did you pick, and then how were they analyzed?
Yeah, so in relation to Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the reason why I wanted to explore that is because, number one, there is a really large humanitarian cost. Some estimates have the death count of 60,000. There was a new one this weekend I saw. It was like 77 to 110,000 people killed. And, you know, that is pretty staggering because of just the large humanitarian cost.
Sure.
You know, regardless of who it is or how it happened, these people are being killed. And number two, the United States is the largest contributor to Israel in terms of arms, right? And our politicians are the ones that decide whether or not to give them weapons. And we, indirectly, through public pressure, through advocating, through discourse, we influence that. And that's the reason why I wanted to analyze the United States, because we have influence. So I decided to look at the three largest American news organizations, that being the CNN, New York Times, and Fox News, all online news organizations.
Okay, so this is only online articles.
Yes.
All right.
Which is important, because I realized there are distinctions between headlines, whether or not it's a news article or a print article. They actually can differ, the headlines.
Can you explain that? I think that's worth noting. So how do they differ? Do you know why they differ?
I think that, you know, we have to acknowledge that these are profit-seeking organizations, right? And they, you know, their goal is to make as much money as possible, and that, you know, they're able to get that through sales, through advertising, through, you know, going directly to the type of consumer. And I think that the people that read the news online compared to in person, like with a physical newspaper, are
sure.
different. So they're going to inherently change how the news is constructed for their certain audience that they're trying to present information to.
Am I wrong in assuming that a clickbaity, I'm doing the air quotes right now, but a clickbaity headline would probably only appear on online because if you already have a print news source like the New York Times, you don't need the clickbait headline. You already have the paper in your hand. You've committed to reading in that medium.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is true, but also there are, you know, have you heard of yellow journalism?
Like William Randolph Hearst yellow journalism? Are we going back?
Yeah, it's a while ago, but yellow journalism is essentially sensationalistic type of reporting, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe if you're in New York City, you see like a newsstand, they have a bunch of headlines, you know, big, bold, you know, trying to get your attention, essentially. So I do think that there are a lot of sensationalistic headlines online, like especially online. But I do think that's still prevalent in news articles. But the reason why I wanted to analyze online news organizations is because they have a larger reach. More people are reading online compared to in-person nowadays.
Yeah, like if I'm going, like I'm just thinking the place that I see the newspaper at the most now is probably when I go to pick up bagels. Yeah. And like, I'm like, oh yeah, there you go. Like there's the New York Post and the New York Times. And even the way that those pages are laid out, I would argue that the New York Post is definitely more eye-catching because of larger font, usually stronger language in the headline. So valid point. Okay, so you're looking online, Fox News, CNN, New York Times. What comes next?
So most in like the current scholarly literature surrounding news framing, right, of this conflict, they mostly analyze full-length articles. Which is really important because a lot of people do read the whole article. But there's most people, around 60% of people, actually don't read the article. They just read the headlines. And I think that, you know, I fall into this category. Many Americans fall through this category. You know, that can be as simple as, you know, they have a news app on their phone. You know, an article comes out, the headline pops up. Right. Or simply, you know, maybe they're running between classes, they're going, you know, walking to get a bagel, and, you know, they're just scrolling through and they see a bunch of headlines. And these headlines are very powerful in shaping our perception because, you know, they're very small, right? They select, emphasize, and exclude a bunch of information, you know, to get to one central message to you.
Sure.
I know that's a lot of information.
But I think the phenomenon that you're talking about is almost, I mean, I see it all the time where someone just goes, oh, did you see this happen with tariffs? Mm-hmm. Oh, did you see this happen with, I mean, because I know that's like, that's been dominating the headlines. Like, oh, did you see the stock market because of the tariffs? And, you know, or what was one I just saw last week? It was like, Donald Trump floated a plan of taxing the rich at a higher rate, but then said maybe we shouldn't do it, but then said we should do it. I didn't read that article. I'm just telling you that that was a headline that basically showed the progression in his position, his reversion, and then his, I guess, acknowledgement again. But because we have these fragmented bits of headlines floating in our heads, I don't know. What do you think is the consequence of that?
Well, you know, through my research, I was able to see that, you know, depending on the headline, it really gives like one very, very secluded part, not secluded, but one part that's away from like the full contextualization of an event or conflict that you're talking about. So let me give you an example.
Yeah, sure.
You know, so say we have an event. This is what I wrote in my research, an event that says an Israeli airstrike in Gaza following a Hamas rocket launch. Right. That's an event that happened.
You is that an actual headline you're reading right now?
No, that's just an example. Same example headline. But you can have a headline that says, you know, Israel launches airstrikes in response to Hamas rocket attack, right? And if you read that, you're going to think, okay, Israeli action is reactive, it's defensive, it's retaliatory to, you know, what Hamas did. But even though you take the same event, but a different headline, right? Headline B, and it says, Israeli airstrikes killed dozens in Gaza as conflict intensifies, right? It changes what you think about the conflict. It goes away from retaliatory, from defensive, and it emphasizes the humanitarian consequences of the conflict, and it frames Israel as their aggressor.
Right, yeah, and that's, so it's the same event, just framed different ways, and really the language difference is just what occurs after that comma of like in response to Hamas. What was it, like missile strike?
Rocket launch.
Rocket launch. So, yeah, that if you're walking around with that kind of fragmented knowledge and you don't know the whole story, that can have consequences because you're just... people tend to not keep the news to themselves, it seems. Mm-hmm. Like when you find something out, you're usually talking to other people about it. And then that can lead into a whole nother can of worms with then it gets into like our interpretation and our group interpretations. But how did you, so you have these three major news organizations. How many headlines did you collect? What did you look at? What were you looking for? And like, did you use a particular method to try to go through all of this data?
So first I decided to retrieve 200 headlines from each news organization.
So that's 600 total.
600 total, yeah. And I did this through just going on their news website and searching up Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I clicked the relevance tab, and there was 200 headlines generated, and I collected all of them, as long as they were published after October 7th, 2023. And I just wanted to stop there and make a point. The reason why I chose October 7th, 2023 is because that's when there was a major escalation in the conflict. Even though this conflict has been one of the largest running, most complex conflicts, you know, in modern history, there are periods of heightened violence.
Oh, this is the most recent flashpoint for sure.
Exactly. So I definitely want to analyze that. And I think what's really, really important about the way I gathered the headlines was it was the same way that someone seeking information about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict would do. So these are the same headlines they would be presented with. You know, okay. If you were just going on and searched up, you know, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, these are the headlines.
Okay.
So my research, my findings reflect the headlines that someone would be shown. You know, not those headlines that may be hidden away, you know, away from, you know, most of the public's view. But what was interesting, though, with my data collection was that Fox News, when you searched up Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they didn't actually have like a full list of articles. They had articles from like 2015. They had articles that were totally unrelated. You actually had to go into separate categories to find articles.
Do you recall what some of those subcategories were?
So there was an Israel category, which encapsulated the conflict, most of it, and like Israeli politics.
Okay.
But also Middle East, but that was the broader Middle East as well.
Okay.
Yeah, which was interesting. But I think even looking at that, you could see who they prioritize in their coverage, right? Like, why does it say Israel but not, you know, Palestine or Palestinians? You know, it's really interesting. We have to think about, you know, who is worthy of coverage or who's worthy of being the focus of coverage.
And was it harder then to find 200 articles on Fox compared to CNN and the New York Times?
I mean, after I realized that, you know, I could just go into Israel category and find a bunch of headlines, it wasn't hard. But it was a lot easier with the New York Times or CNN, where I could just search up Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the headlines immediately pop up.
All right, so you've got the headlines. Now what do you do? Other than put them in a giant spreadsheet of 600 headlines. Yeah. What happens next?
I want to find out what they're actually covering, and then I can find out how they cover it. So I did a thematic coding process, which I looked at each headline, and I looked at what they're actually covering. And this can be multiple things. And, looked at each headline, found out what they're covering, and I was able to, you know, put in the spreadsheet where I can find, you know, Fox News covers X percent of their coverage on, like, for instance, Israeli violence against Palestinians, right? And I'm able to find different distributions of data.
Okay. And what did this thematic analysis reveal?
Yeah, it was really interesting because you could see that there was significant differences in coverage. So, for instance, I focused a lot on the violence, on suffering. So for CNN and the New York Times, they both covered Israeli military action against Palestinians more than that of Palestinian militant action against Israelis, which is more equitable to the reality of the conflict because Israel has conducted much, much more military operations than that of Palestinian factions. Interestingly, though, Fox News actually reverses this and covers Palestinian militant action against Israel more. And this is really interesting because when we look at headlines or when we read articles, usually what we think about is, you know, if they're covering one group's violence more than the others, then, you know, they have to be doing more violence, if that makes sense.
Well, in your mind, like if you're constantly being told that XYZ group is, like if you see headlines of that particular group acting aggressively, then you're going to perceive that they are the aggressor, I would think.
Exactly.
Okay.
So Fox News actually reverses this. And it makes you think that the Palestinian factions are actually doing more violence against Israel, which is not true. Which is really important. And also when we cover suffering, again, CNN and the New York Times does cover Palestinian suffering more than that of Israeli suffering. And I know it's hard for some people to think about, oh, you can't quantify suffering. You can't say one group's suffering is more than others. I would somewhat go against that because, you know, there is quantifiable data that says that, you know, around, I think, 1,800 or 1,200 Israelis have been killed in the conflict since October 7, 2023. But then you have, you know, estimates of 60,000, 70,000 Palestinians being killed. And I think that with CNN and the New York Times having more equitable reporting of suffering in relation to deaths and injuries, they're able to be a lot more fair with their reporting.
So if I'm understanding your thematic process right here, suffering would be anything in a headline that would be an indication of death or injury.
Yeah, death, injury, it could be starvation.
Okay.
It's a multitude of factors.
Okay. But all of that would be under this umbrella theme of suffering for both Palestinians and Israelis in this conflict.
Correct.
Okay, so you have a difference there between Fox, CNN, and the New York Times with more, I'm going to say, I guess, a more similar pattern in reporting being seen in the New York Times and CNN as different from Fox.
But one thing about suffering I didn't mention before is Fox News also reverses it. Covering Israeli suffering more than Palestinian suffering. Which is similar to the reversal of, you know, the reality of the conflict in terms of violence. So it seems like, you know, they're trying to shape a victimhood narrative that I'll expand later on. This is what they cover. But how they cover it can also be very different as well. And I think this is really exemplified through their use of language in terms of like calling which actors certain names. So let me make this make sense.
Yeah, use some examples from your data.
Yeah, so CNN and New York Times, they both call Hamas or Hezbollah in Lebanon, they call them militants, right? And when you think militant, what do you think?
I guess it, like an informal, almost group, almost like a militia, like an informal group of armed individuals who are fighting for something.
And if I say, what do you think of terrorist?
A terrorist would then be, it's like, I guess it would be similar to that group, but being aggressively engaging in some kind of ideology and trying to make sure that that ideology becomes supreme in whatever context they're operating within.
Yes, I totally agree with you. That's what I think. I would think most people would think. They would think that if you were to compare militant, the word militant and the word terrorist, they would say terrorist is much more of a negative word. It's a harmful word to use.
Well, it's way more. In my mind, it's way more extreme than militant.
Mm-hmm. And so New York Times and CNN both use the word militant, right, to describe Hamas, Hezbollah in Lebanon. But then Fox News, again, they differ from the three news organizations, and they call Hamas, Hezbollah, they call them terrorists, right? And whether or not you think they're a terrorist or not, they give off a different perception when they're being called terrorists, right? They're inherently more dark, inherently more, more essentially like more bad. They're the enemy. They're created the perception of being the enemy.
Well, if I was just walking, you know, if you're saying like scrolling through your phone through headlines and you see the word terrorist, there's probably an emotional response that's going to be elicited way more than the word militant, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And I think that when we think of the word terrorist, we immediately think just, you know, bad, because it's very emotionally charged when we see, you know, a lot of violence, you know, happening all over the world. And I think the issue of using the word terrorist is that it delegitimizes any valid political grievances one may have.
So then how do you like, what do you think then is a fair way of representing this based on what you saw?
So I think that,
so like, do you use the word militant? Do you use the word terrorist? Or is it, there's no judgment there. It's just, if you use the word militant, this is the consequence. And if you use the word terrorist, this is the consequence. And what do you think of that?
So I think that by using the word terrorist, you're inherently placing a judgment upon the actor or organization you're referring to.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, it depends on the, you know, news organization. If they're inherently wanting to provide, you know, objective information where, you know, they're allowing the audience to, you know, look at these facts and come up with their own opinion on what's happening or, you know, what group, like how a group represents themselves, then, yeah, I think you should use the word militant because it is inherently more neutral. But if you want to go and place the, you know, place a judgment upon something, yeah, you can use the word terrorist. But it's important to note that when you use that word, you're going to immediately just, you know, place a group upon, you know, just being bad. And I think that it has ripple effects because when, you know, even if you just generalize everyone as a terrorist, it takes away from anything valid that they may provide because you're just thinking bad, bad, bad.
Your work gets into a lot of different things, but it seems like this focus on language and the impact of language is a key part. So what if we turn this for a moment domestically? I know we don't have a ton of time left. Mm-hmm. And you apply this to a group like the Oath Keepers or the Proud Boys. If you refer to them as militant groups in some contexts, but then they're referred to as terrorists in other ones, like, could someone take your work and then examine a domestic militant group and then try to see Fox News, CNN, New York Times, are they using the militant and terrorist language in a different context domestically? I guess, could that be done using the framework you utilized?
Yeah, that could totally be done. And I think that, you know, as I said before, it's how you want to place judgment, right? If you want to totally delegitimize a group, whether that be a good thing or a bad thing, then yeah, use the word terrorist because you're just going to represent them as bad, right? You're going to represent them as inherently harmful. But if you do want to portray them in a more neutral stance where the audience can, you know, come up with their own opinions about that group, and you don't want to totally delegitimize, you know, maybe there are some, you know, valid political arguments that they may have, then I think the word militant would be better.
So then those judgments being made by the audience, ideally, I guess, would we say that that's happening in the body of the text where maybe there's more nuance than the headline exists?
I think that, you know, there may be more nuance within the text. However, my research mostly focuses on headlines. And I think that because, you know, headlines are very short. They can only provide some information. And I read this article a while ago, but it said that journalists are inherently subjective because you can't cover everything.
No.
Another author I was reading talked about how they select information to talk about, right? Whether that be violence, suffering, they emphasize that through only talking about that within their headline, and they have to exclude everything else just for feasibility purposes. And that can lead to, you know, one thing really standing out, and that's what your attention is going to be on.
If all reporting is subjective, and it definitely seems, I mean, it is, mm-hmm. like, how could it not be? Media reporting is an entire system made by people. And I think you and I were talking about the most recent executive order last week regarding the cutting of funding to NPR and PBS. And I think the executive order used the language of like unbiased news source. And we were talking like there's no such thing as an unbiased news source. I think people need to get that out of their heads. Every news source is biased. So bringing this back to the original reason why you did this, which is for consumers of news to be more aware of how media is being framed to them, what do we do? Like for people out there who consume the news as much as you do, how do they find maybe not the truth, because that might be super hard to find, but a better representation of what is occurring outside of their normal realm of experience. Again, because if you're not in Israel or Palestine right now, you're not living it. Mm-hmm. So how do we find a more accurate representation in our news media?
Well, I think that, number one, do not just read headlines. Because,
okay, valid.
You know, headlines, as I said before, you know, they're very small. They don't give you much information. And they can be very, very misleading. Number two, I would say, you know, even if you do read full-length articles, don't take everything at face value. You know, criticize it. Think about, you know, why they said it, potential biases they may have, you know, who supports that news organization financially, you know, publicly, etc. And I also think that diversify what you read.
Okay.
You know, think about different arguments that people use. Because, you know, if you get trapped in an echo chamber of only listening to, you know, one type of argument, you know, supported by the same evidence, you're going to inherently believe it, right? That's the only information you have.
Yeah, it becomes your belief system.
You know, if you read, you know, people like to, you know, say left-wing, right-wing articles. But if you were to, you know, read only left-wing articles, you're going to, you know, come out with a left-wing ideology. So maybe read, I think that everyone should diversify in their thinking. And this diversity will allow you to come up with your own conclusion, because by reading so many different things, you're not going to come up with, you're not going to read one article or one news source and be, and come up with that thought, if that makes sense, right?
That makes sense. And I think that maybe instead of your own conclusion, a more whole conclusion might even be a better way to frame that. But laterally reading, for example, like if you go to a website, don't just be on that one article the entire time. If they have links, I always tell my students this, like if there are links, you should have other tabs open, fact check pieces of evidence, really evaluate it, and see where the consensus lies among sources. All right, well, that's the bell. But any words of advice for research students? How about that, to close with that?
For research students, I definitely think that, you know, there's more work to do. I analyzed headlines of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but, you know, there's other conflicts that are overlooked, but are still very important. Our perception is very important. And I think that, you know, most of the current scholarly literature has looked into full-length articles, and I looked at headlines. But there's other multimedia elements that, you know, are taking into consideration, you know, short form video clips, images, you know, the subtitles to the images.
Highly influential.
Yeah, especially with AI coming out, you know, creating those images. I think that there's a lot of work to do to find out how these news organizations frame different, you know, not just conflicts, but news in general, and how that perception leads to real world consequences.
And on that note, thank you, Wesley.
Thanks.
Have a nice rest of your day. And, you know, for the people suffering from seasonal allergies, Wesley just powered through. So
yeah, I'm struggling.
All right. Take care.